Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Hi there, and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. And we are not live today. We recorded some things for you, some fresh ideas, some new information for you, and we're featuring some of our favorite phone calls. All right, to start off the show, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Umat discussing something very important as we're aging.
Okay, well, folks, we're back at the top of the hour. So let's chat a little bit about menopause.
Yeah. You know, even though a lot of people are doing it, I do find at these conferences, too, there are a lot of people that know nothing about it.
Yeah.
And even now, Dr. Smith was talking again, and I hadn't heard her in a while. And the same thing, you know, she's like, okay, so many people are still doing it wrong.
Most people are doing it wrong, quite frankly. Yeah, let's kind of run through what's really happening with menopause. And guys, don't tune out because you have someone in your life who is menopausal. And part of what we're going to discuss also involves andropause, that is the male equivalent of menopause. You know, menopause is defined as a midlife woman who has stopped having her period and has not menstruated for 1 year or more. If you go for a year without a period and you're a midlife woman of appropriate age, you are by definition menopausal. So what do we treat when we treat menopause? Are we trying to restart their periods?
No, most women don't want that.
Right, but if we're going to define the condition,
yes,
by menstruation, then wouldn't treating the condition involve restarting menstruation?
Well, some, yes. And in some cultures, so, that's accepted as okay.
Yes,
but,
it is.
But in some other, and then again, you know, if we do that, then it's A, inconvenient, and B, sometimes the symptoms are of cancer are masked, and so we may miss early problems.
Well, my point in saying that is that we have misidentified what menopause is. We're defining it based on menstruation. Okay, but that's not what's causing the problem. A woman does not get osteoporosis and brain dysfunction and mood swings and depression and joint degeneration and skin that's looking like she's 20 years older than she is because she stopped having her period.
Right.
It's not stopping the period that caused the problem.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
And so we're going at this thing backwards.
Yeah, it's much broader.
The reality is what's causing her condition, what's causing all of her problems, is the decline in at least six different hormones, not just estrogen.
Yeah.
Six different things are falling apart, and stopping the period is the symptom of some of those changes, but it's not the cause. Mm. We should be defining menopause as a global hormonal deficiency disease.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of run through those list of those six hormones and talk about what each of the six do.
Mm.
Okay. First, everybody knows about estrogen and menopause. Okay. What they don't know is that you've only lost about 50% of your estrogen at the time you stop having periods. you still have the other half of your estrogen. Now, it'll still continue to decline, but you won't get down to no estrogen until you're at least 75 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So you got another 25 years or more to lose the other half of your estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
But when the estrogen is declining, several things are happening. Estrogen is a potent anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. It decreases inflammation everywhere, including in your brain. And so as estrogen levels are declining, inflammation throughout your body is starting to rise.
Mm.
And so part of the mood swings and the depressive disorders are triggered by the inflammation that results from declining estrogen levels.
Mm.
Okay. Estrogen inhibits the osteoclast in the bone. Now, that means nothing to most of you, so let me explain. There are two kinds of cells involved in bone metabolism. The osteoblast makes new bone. The osteoclast dissolves old bone. Okay? Bone is a living tissue. It's not like a dead wooden plank. It's always turning over. You're always making new bone and getting rid of the old worn-out bone. So that's a cycle. But as estrogen levels decline, the osteoclast becomes more active and starts dissolving bone faster. And that predisposes you to osteoporosis. You start to lose the bone. It's not a calcium deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a myth from the 1930s. People knew that you were losing calcium from your bones. And so the answer was, well, then let's make her eat or drink more calcium.
Mm.
Well, that doesn't help, because the problem is your lower estrogen is speeding up the osteoclast. And the lower your estrogen goes over the next 25 years, the faster those osteoclasts will be working to dissolve your bones.
Hmm.
Okay. So let's go to the skin for a minute.
Okay.
Estrogen makes the skin smooth. It's highly vascular. It gives you that ruddy glow of youth. It makes the skin give you that youthful, pretty, feminine glow.
Hmm.
Estrogen also decreases scarring when you get injured. Okay. So estrogen is really important. And yes, it's also involved in not in having periods, but not to the extent of the next hormone,
right,
which is progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you're 50, you've lost about 2/3 of your progesterone. 50% of the estrogen's gone, but 2/3 of the progesterone is. And it's the progesterone that ripens up that uterus, that puts the endometrium, the lining of the uterus, is supposed to then be a nice, rich, blood-supplied place for an egg to implant and grow a new baby. When you don't get pregnant, that progesterone level drops, and about a week or so later, the lining of the uterus sloughs off and drains out, and that's what your menstrual period was.
Mm-hmm.
The reason your periods are stopping is that your progesterone is down about 2/3. And with that 2/3 lower progesterone, you don't have enough to develop the endometrium. So there's nothing left to slough. So your periods are not caused by low estrogen. The stop in your periods is caused by low progesterone.
Hmm.
Okay. Next one. Thyroid.
Mm-hmm.
Your thyroid is at its peak when you're young and adolescent. And thyroid is an energy metabolism adjuster. When you have enough thyroid, your metabolism is perking along and you're burning calories. Your brain is working fast. Your body is working fast and you tend to be leaner. As your thyroid levels decline with age, you slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain slows down. You get a little brain fog. You're not able to concentrate as well. Your metabolism is slowing. And so with the same diet, you start gaining weight.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that perky, bright feeling with the thyroid, as that declines, depression becomes an issue. So the inflammation from the low estrogen plus the lower thyroid function often makes menopausal women depressed.
Mm.
Okay. And hence, that's why about half of the women at menopause get put on an antidepressant, as though the doctor thinks that menopause is a Prozac deficiency,
right.
And it's not.
It's not.
Okay?
Yes.
It's not that you don't have enough antidepressants in your system. It's that you don't have estrogen or thyroid. Mm. But now let's go to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Testosterone.
Yeah.
Testosterone is a woman's primary hormone. She has 2.5 to 3 times more testosterone than she had estrogen when she was young.
Mm.
But by menopause, estrogen's down 50%, progesterone's down around 65%, testosterone is down 80%.
Mm.
Testosterone in the brain gives you drive and ambition and self-confidence and optimism about the future and stress tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've lost 80% of your testosterone, you get tired, slow, depressed. You don't handle stress, your high anxiety levels, your energy declines, along with your interest in sex.
Mm-hmm.
So your libido is faded, which causes problems. Because by age 50, 50% of men have some degree of erectile dysfunction, but 70% of women have lost interest in sex.
Yeah.
And so that makes some really unhappy men in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So what else is involved with menopause? Oh, yeah, dehydroepiandrosterone, another adrenal steroid that causes bone density. It makes your bones stronger. Oh, yeah, I forgot about the testosterone. Testosterone stimulates new bone growth.
Right, it does. Yeah.
So as you've lost your testosterone, you're producing new bone slower.
Yeah.
And you're dissolving it faster.
Right.
And that is where your osteoporosis is coming from. It doesn't matter how much or how little calcium you're eating.
Right.
Okay. Your problem is low testosterone and low DHEA are causing you to make bone slower, and low estrogen is causing you to dissolve it faster. And that combination has shifted your bone balance towards bone loss over time.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. And then pregnenolone.
And then pregnenolone, which is our other one we need. Pregnenolone is a sleep and stress and anxiety drug. So pregnenolone, when those levels decline, you start having trouble sleeping at night.
Right.
Okay? You're tired. You're lethargic because your testosterone and your thyroid are down, but you can't seem to sleep worth a hoot. And that's because your pregnenolone is too low. Pregnenolone is also an anti-anxiety drug that helps you cope with stress.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, you're starting to get obsessive about the grandkids or the kids and their financial problems. And every stressor in life starts smacking you upside the head a lot harder than it used to. And again, that's low pregnenolone.
Mm.
Okay. So if you look at what's really going on with menopause, it's not just stopping your periods.
No.
Okay. And we should not be defining menstruation. We should not be defining it by in terms of menstruation.
That's right. Yeah. There are a couple of things we didn't mention, Jerry, about cortisol and insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So those are also playing a huge role. These are declining. Cortisol may either be increasing or decreasing depending upon what your status is and what the history has been, which plays a huge role in your ability to handle stress and develop adrenal fatigue. And then finally, with insulin and insulin resistance, that weight just doesn't come off, no matter how hard you try.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hormones are not helping you build muscle or bone. And then the high insulin level is not letting you lose weight. And the cortisol is not helping you manage that stress. It's a recipe for all the problems that women do undergo during that time.
So you need to recognize that this midlife change is not a matter of your period. To heck with the periods. We can make you keep those or lose them, but it's all this other stuff that we have to pay attention to.
Right.
Now, gentlemen, I've been talking about menopause because that's what we do. Let me just touch for 1 or 2 minutes on andropause.
Sure.
Andropause is the male equivalent, except we don't have a period to mark it by. So andropause has gone unremarked for decades.
Right.
But every single one of those hormones that I was just discussing, you make too.
Yeah.
And by the time you're 50, the very same thing is happening to you that happened to your wife. All of those hormones are declining. And you're getting the side effects of that. Depression is almost an expected issue with midlife because the testosterone, the dehydroepiandrosterone, the thyroid, all these things that give us bright, active, happy, outgoing, optimistic lives are fading with those hormone decline. And gentlemen, that's you too.
That's right.
And so you need to come in and let us evaluate you.
Yeah.
You need to, not just your wife, the men need to come in and be evaluated.
Right. You know, the risk for andropause and osteopenia, osteoporosis in men is increasing. In fact, their baseline testosterone levels are falling.
Yes, they are. And that's, you know, that's really kind of sad.
It is.
So, so yes, guys, come on in. Let us evaluate you along with your wife. This needs to be a couple's project, because if one of you is bright and optimistic and cheerful and upgoing and starts getting better muscle and better bone and better brain, and it leaves the other one behind, this is sad. This makes a real mismatch in a marriage. So I need the two of you to come in together.
Right.
And let us work on this.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Right. And, well, what else should we talk about?
Senescent cells, maybe?
Senescent cells? Well, yeah, we only got 30 seconds left in this segment. Okay. So we're going to come back in just a few minutes, and we're going to talk about senescent cells in men and women.
Sounds like a plan.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells.
All right. Well, in the last segment, I promised we were going to talk about senescent cells.
Right.
Okay. And I have to tell you, a big part of getting rid of Santa's belly and making him lean and buff was treating his senescent cells.
Yeah.
Okay. Mrs. Claus was so delighted when we cleaned up his senescent cells. So let me explain what senescent cells are all about.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Yeah. Every cell in your body is designed to do its job for a specified period of time, and then it wears out and is supposed to die, get broken up, and replaced by a new cell to take its place. And different cells survive different amounts of time. When you were a baby, your skin was turned over almost every day. That's why you could get a kid with a terrible case of a diaper rash. You know, you put the desiccant ointment on it, keep the poop off the skin for 24 hours, and it was healed. He grew all new skin.
Right. You know? Right. So, yeah. A little bit slower in the older people.
Yes. By the time you're in your 20s to early 30s, you're replacing your skin about every 2 weeks. So you've gone from every day to every 2 weeks. By the time you're in your 50s, you're replacing your skin about once a month. And by the time you're in 70s and 80s, it may take a month and a half or 2 months to get new skin. So skin is being turned over much more slowly as we age. The lining of your gut, on the other hand, when you're young, it turns over about every 30 hours. So you get a virus infection and it gives you raging diarrhea because the virus is damaging your gut lining. And 12 hours later, it's gone. And in 20, 30 hours, you can have a whole new lining to your bowel. Your muscles, on the other hand, they tend to turn over about every month to 6 weeks.
Yeah. So it's true to say you're turning over a new leaf.
Your bone.
Yeah.
You replace about 10% of your bone every year. So every 10 years, you got a whole new skeleton. So bone turns over slower. Brain cells also turn over.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in medical school, we thought they lasted forever.
Right.
They don't. But they turn over very slowly, years, even decades to turn over a brain cell. So, you know, some things turn over quickly, some turn over slowly. But every tissue in your body has a pre-programmed expected lifespan at any given point in your age.
Right.
Most of the time, those cells, when they hit the end of their programmed life, they do die and they get replaced. Good. Now you got a fresh new cell. But nothing done to or by human beings is perfect, and that includes cell turnover. A small percentage of cells reach the end of their lifespan, and instead of dying and being replaced, they refuse to die. Mm. They become the zombie cells, the living dead. These cells are still alive, but they won't do their job anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they're putting all their energy into is producing chemicals that say, don't grow, don't replace, don't change, just sit there.
Yeah.
Okay. But that doesn't just affect that cell.
Right.
Because it's dumping these chemical products out into the cellular environment, and it's affecting every cell around it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one really bad zombie cell can inhibit the growth and repair of 12,000 healthy cells. That's a problem.
That's a lot of cells
that
now, you know, are not performing well.
And so when we're young, our immune system is very good at finding and killing those zombie cells.
Yeah.
They form, our immune system says, no, you don't. And it comes in, and in a matter of a day or so, it finds and kills those cells.
Mm.
But as we're aging, our immune system is becoming less and less vigilant. That's why it's not finding and killing the cancers like we'd like it to. That's why we get sick more often. It's not as good at stopping the viruses and the bacteria. Well, it's not as good as finding and killing the zombie cells. So those zombie cells will now last 2 to 3 weeks instead of one day.
Huh.
And we're producing them faster and faster. And zombie cells, just like the zombies in the movie, they go around making new zombies. Zombie cells make new zombie cells. Those chemicals that they're producing induce zombification, if that is such a word.
You created that word.
Of the healthy cells. But sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Zombification. I may put that one in Wikipedia. So, okay. Science can be fun, guys. Come on. Let's lighten up and enjoy ourselves. So, so what happens is, as we age, we get a logarithmic increase in the number of zombie cells in our body. We're making them faster and we're clearing them dramatically slower. And so they just pile up.
Right.
And as they pile up, they start telling the rest of our body, don't heal, don't repair, don't grow. For goodness sakes, if you grow, you're going to kill us. You know, don't grow. And so we start healing more slowly. We repair more slowly. If we exercise, we don't do as good a job of making new muscle because the zombie cells are saying, don't grow any new tissue.
Yeah.
Okay. Everything in our body starts to go downhill. There comes a point when the zombie cells build up to such a high level that it becomes almost impossible to grow new tissue. And in fact, you can reach a point at which tissues are starting to die faster than they can be produced. We call that sarcopenia. You start sliding downhill, your muscle, your bone, your brain, your gut, everything starts to become more and more and more dysfunctional. And these are the old folks that are in the nursing home that just dwindle away and die of old age. They are killed by the zombies in their system, which is really kind of sad. Now, here's the good news. We are the zombie hunters.
Okay.
We know how to kill zombie cells. We've actually got some therapy. It's a combination of dasatinib and quercetin. The dasatinib is, in fact, an antineoplastic. It's a cancer drug that we have had around for decades. We know all its side effects, all its ups and downs. It's been used on tens of thousands of people. It's designed to be used every day for years at a time. We only use it for 3 days at a time. We use it 3 days each week for 3 weeks. In 9 days, we can knock out about 70% of your zombie cells. That's pretty fascinating. So what happens is we treat you for 3 days each week for 3 weeks. And your zombie cells over the course of the next week or 10 days will just kind of fade away and die. You still keep about 30% of them. And you find after about 2 weeks after therapy, you're suddenly able to start making new muscle. You start to get more energy. Your brain clears. You're able to function better because you have 70% fewer zombie cells in your system trying to gum up the works. Mm. Now, because human beings live a long time, sooner or later you'll start making new zombie cells. So periodically, we need to go in and clear your zombies. Mm. So generally, we hit you with a full course of therapy about twice a year. Mm. But some people, especially those that are significantly overweight or have other health problems or are diabetic, we may have to hit them a little more often. They may need a light touch-up every month or every other month. So this has to be personalized like everything else we do at Longevity Medical Clinic.
Right.
There is no one right for everybody therapy.
Mm. Okay?
But I am treating myself about twice a year with the dasatinib quercetin.
Right.
And boy, do I feel the results.
Sure. But then you also noticed a change after the Buck Institute mentioned about rapamycin.
Oh, yes. But see, rapamycin also decreases zombie cells.
Yes.
Not as efficiently as the dasatinib.
Yeah.
But it slows the production of zombie cells.
Yeah.
And it kills some.
Right.
So if you're on rapamycin, we don't need to treat you as aggressively with the dasatinib.
Mm.
If you're on rapamycin, once a year may be enough.
Mm.
Okay. Or you may only need one full therapy and one or two partial therapies in the year. Because the rapamycin works by a totally different mechanism, and yet it does decrease the number of zombies in your system.
Right.
Just not as efficiently
as
the dasatinib. You know, it's interesting in the animal studies. Rapamycin, the higher the dose we use, the longer the animals live.
Mm.
So with a moderate dose, we add about 10 or 11% to their lifespan. With a high dose, we get up around 12% increased lifespan. And at maximum doses of rapamycin, you add about 15% to the lifespan.
Mm.
Now, 15% is not bad if you figure the average American is going to make it nearly 80 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, 10% is 8 more years and 5% is 4 years, so 12 more years.
Mm.
So if you were going to die at 80 and I can get you up to 92, that's useful.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. But the dasatinib therapy in the animals gives them a 36% increased lifespan.
Mm.
Well, now, let's say in a person that was going to be 80, and if we started them early enough and treated their senescent cells all the way through, we might get a 30 or plus 30, 35, 36% increase. Okay, so that's 8 plus 8 is 16 plus 8 is 24.
Well, hang on. Life expectancy is decreasing in the United States right now.
Yes. But my point is, in theory, you could make it to 107, 108 instead of 92.
Mm.
And what happens if we do the two together? Oh, now we are way out in speculationville here.
I know. We are really speculating way, way too much.
But it is fun.
It is fun.
Because if we could extrapolate the animal studies to us humans, we actually now have two drugs that used together might well give us 110-year expected lifespan.
Well, we don't know.
That's right.
In fact, you know, Dan Buettner was at the conference, and he was one of the keynote speakers.
Yeah.
So he's talked about the Blue Zones and his research and National Geographic productions. It was interesting to listen to his perspective, and I've also watched the series. So there was no dasatinib. There was no rapamycin.
But they were doing things that slowed the production of zombie cells.
That's right.
They stay lean.
Yes.
Body fat increases zombification.
Yeah.
The fatter you are, the higher your load of zombies is going to be.
Right. Right.
Muscle, working muscle, kills zombie cells.
Yeah.
The more muscle you've got and the more physically active you are, the fewer zombies you'll have.
Yes.
The less insulin resistance you have and the lower your blood sugars, the fewer your zombie cells.
That's right.
And so the people in those blue zones are staying lean with a high-fiber natural diet, and they're exercising every day, walking for miles and working in the fields.
Right.
And so they're knocking down their zombie cells, and they're living much longer than the rest.
That's right. And the other parts are, you know, the social connectivity and the purpose in life. So he talks about what is your purpose, what is your ikigai, and lots of different things that will contribute. Again, the Harvard study confirms that as well. The longest ongoing study ever in the history of the United States, still ongoing. And they also, they looked at socioeconomic status, whether education status was playing a role or not. And they also confirmed that it's more about the connectivities.
Activities. Yeah. You know, I phrase that a little different.
Okay.
If you really want to have a healthy emotional life, you need two things. You need to love and be loved.
Fair enough.
If there are people in your life that you truly love and you are confident that they love you, you are thoroughly connected.
Yeah. Right. And it, and again, that connectivity doesn't mean it has to be broad. It can only be a few.
Yes.
It can be two or three, and that's enough.
That's right.
But that is what you do need.
Now, most wives out there do not want your husband loving two or three.
Oh, that's right. I have to qualify everything over here, Jerry.
Unless it's you and the children and the grandchildren. He's allowed to love all of them.
And that's what it is. It's about the social. Like he was saying that in Japan, in Okinawa, they eat together.
Yes.
And there's also this feeling of, you know, you get up when you're 80% full. You don't eat to satiety. You get up before you're full.
Which is a problem that has helped with the rapamycin, though, because older people, at least in the Western culture, I have not seen a study on Eastern, but Western culture, as we age, we tend to lose our appetite sensors. And we can't tell when we've eaten enough.
Right.
And we end up eating until our stomach is distended and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Okay. And the rapamycin in most people seems to restore that sensing mechanism so we know when we've eaten enough.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's kind of important too.
It is very important. So. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've had another segment disappear.
That went by fast.
Well, I hope you guys are learning a little something, but mostly I hope you go out, love and be loved. Spread joy freely and enjoy every day of your life. I want you to enjoy this Christmas, enjoy the New Year's, enjoy those around you every chance you get.
Outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Man, it doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought me some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight,
it's Leading Edge Medicine. Let it snow. Let it snow. Doctors are talking about all sorts of things and things behind the scenes here at Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Samira is laughing. I'm Lynette. Dr.
We were
Samira
talking about
that here. And Dr. Nixon.
Side effects of some medications.
Yeah. Wow. We talk about everything on the show.
It was explicit and I was medical.
And she was laughing and I was doing my job. Okay, so so talking about those supplements for stroke.
They're not supplements. I'm sorry.
They're not?
No. Okay. That's there were three things that had a dramatic effect on decreasing the risk of dying from heart attacks and strokes.
Okay.
But they were all three prescription drugs.
Mm.
The first one was simply a statin. Any of the anti-cholesterol drugs, the statins, they lower the risk of dying of heart attack and stroke somewhat. It's not profound. It's, you know, it's a 10 or 15%. Yeah, a modest decrease.
Maybe even less than that,
But they do help. Then testosterone. testosterone reduced the risk of dying of a heart attack or stroke more than twice as much as the statins did. So it's actually more effective than the anti-cholesterol drugs. And then there was the tadalafil, the PDE5 inhibitor, which is used for erectile disorder generally, although I use it on almost everybody, male and female, because it's got a lot of other benefits that I like. That one lowered your risk of dying twice as much as testosterone. And when you put the three together, you reduced the risk of dying from a heart attack or stroke from a peak of 30% to less than 2%.
Wow.
A dramatic improvement in your risks. So most of our patients are on the PDE5 inhibitor and the testosterone. We don't have a lot of people on the statins, just because we are usually able to lower their cholesterol other ways. We do have some that need a statin, but not the majority of our people. But most of our people are on the two in that triad that do a really great job. One of them reducing it four times more than the statin, and the other one, you know, twice as much as the statin. So that's the combination. But unfortunately, none of them are over the counter. They all require a prescription. Does that help, sir?
Yes, definitely. Somewhat related quick question is, you had also mentioned in the past where obviously I'm an older patient, I've already lost an inch or two of height, and that there was some supplement that would tend to stop
that loss, yes,
of height.
Yeah, and again, it's not supplement, but if you're one of our patients, I can almost guarantee that you're on those medicines already. And one of them is testosterone, which stimulates new bone growth. And it actually impacts, it saves and increases the number of stem cells in your bone marrow. And it stimulates the osteoblasts to make new bone cells to help you grow new bone. And in older men, we usually allow your estrogen to rise a bit, because that rising estrogen will inhibit bone loss. So it's a three-pronged approach. We want the estrogen to slow your bone loss with aging. We want the testosterone to stimulate the osteoblast to make new bone. And we want the testosterone to stimulate your bone marrow to make more stem cells to enhance the healing and repairing of your skeleton. Does that answer your question?
That does. And just if I could sneak in just a quick one.
Sure.
You were mentioning something by the name of dasatinib.
Yes.
Carcinibib.
Yeah, dasatinib.
How do you spell that? And is that a prescription item?
Yeah, I'm going to give you to Samara because she's the speller in the group.
Dasatinib is dasatinib. Okay. Dasatinib.
Yes, and you take it with quercetin.
With quercetin, all right.
Yeah.
And I guess I could bring that up with my my doctor at the clinic.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely, you should, yes.
Yeah, they all know a whole lot about dasatinib quercetin therapies. So
right,
yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I am a fairly new patient, so...
Usually we get people in the first 6 months or so and get their hormones stable before we do things like the dasatinib quercetin. So if you're a fairly new patient, your doctor may just not have gotten around to it you yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you mention it, tell them you're interested. They'll evaluate you and see if you have any risk factors that make them nervous. Okay.
Okay. Very good, doctor. I certainly appreciate, everything you do in your service. Yes.
All right. You're welcome, sir. Well, happy to help.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's get back to our phones. We have from Redmond, Julia calling in. Hi there, Julia. Thanks for waiting.
Hello, Julia.
Yeah, hi. I've got a question for you. I went in to have my cholesterol checked, and when I looked at my chart, my doctor said everything looked just perfectly fine. But when I looked at the numbers, they did not look fine to me.
All right.
So my MCV and RDW were high. They were off the little graph, and my MCHC was low, off the graph, which when I looked it up is indicative of anemia. But I know there's some kinds that are caused by disease, some kinds that are caused by diet. Like, how do you know the difference? Like what do you do about that?
All right. Now, when you said you went in to see your doctor, is one of our doctors?
No, although I do have an appointment with you guys for the health analysis. Okay. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, and my cholesterol, by the way, was 269, and she said I didn't need statins with that.
Right. So, you know, you started with cholesterol, and then you mentioned MCV and MCHC and RDW, and that's complete blood counts. So,
that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
Two very different
areas.
So she did a panel. Yeah, she did a panel. And then so I looked at the panel and went, well, she's saying this is normal, but I'm seeing things that are off the little graph, you know.
Mm. Yep.
So.
Well, the cholesterol is significantly higher than I want it to be. But statins have their downsides, so usually we're able to get your cholesterol down without having to use the statins. So that's usually our first approach.
Right, and then, you know, the total cholesterol is just one marker in that whole panel. There's a lot of other information that would be very useful.
That's right. Well, and the other thing is, you know, do we want to do
Cleveland
Heart Lab study on her so that we can actually fractionate that cholesterol.
Absolutely.
And look at, you know, about 6 or 8 different components of it. So the cholesterol is too high, but if you become a patient, we'll be checking out more about your cholesterol because we want to break that down into different types of cholesterol, particle sizes, APO little a,
right,
etc.
People get scared, but you know, remember, you've had cholesterol all your life. Your cholesterol is important building block of the cells. Cholesterol is necessary.
Yes.
It's just
without cholesterol, you'd be dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
But when it rises and forms plaque and blocks flow of blood or breaks off a fragment to cause a stroke, that's when it becomes a problem.
That's when it becomes a problem. You're right.
Okay.
It's because cholesterol is the mother hormone. All of your other hormones are made out of cholesterol. I had to change that to the just about because thyroid is not.
Yeah.
but most of the other steroid hormones are. Yeah.
And then the complete blood count, the MCV, RDW, and MCHC.
Yeah,
that means so
why
you
over that.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't even, you know, if they give you little parameters, and mine were off the parameters. So I don't know how she can say that's normal.
Yeah, well, your hemoglobin, hematocrit sounded like they were.
She didn't tell us those.
No, but so they must have been okay, or she would have mentioned
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were okay.
Okay.
Which is good because, you know, so what we're looking for is risk for anemia, which is what you mentioned, and you will need a little bit more information from you and about your history in order to confirm that. Now, it could be iron deficiency or vitamin B12 and folate deficiency. So one is microcytic, the other one is macrocytic. So the cell size is important to know here. And so there's a lot more information. And then we look at risk factors, and age is important because there's one very common thing called anemia of chronic disease. Mm-hmm. So if you've had chronic issues over a lifetime, then the likelihood of some of these being outliers rises. And if you've had the problem for a longer time, then we like to look at what is it doing over time. Is it getting better or is it getting worse? And remember, sometimes you can also get lab outliers, and that again happens commonly. And so that's why we collect a lot of data. We collect data so we look for trends over time, and then we know how to read outliers more efficiently and effectively when we see them, because the trends don't indicate that there is a problem. So, you know, like the other person mentioned about the alk phos being high, right? Classic example. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, where would I go with this? What would be the next test if you need more information? Because I don't have chronic illness. I'm pretty healthy.
Well, actually, looking at the rest of that test, there are parameters you didn't give us, okay, like the hemoglobin, hematocrit, and so on. So just looking at what's already been done will probably give her a significant amount of knowledge. But then they may want to, again, do a different form of cholesterol test that's far more precise and detailed than the standard cholesterol testing. That will give us a lot more information about your risk, too.
Okay.
Is that it?
So as far as anemia goes, they just need more information.
Yeah, they do. But they
can go.
But the hemoglobin and hematocrit, since they're within the normal range, you're not overtly anemic yet. So that tells me you're not overtly anemic, but those parameters tell me you may be moving in that direction.
Okay.
So, right? Okay. We'll see you in the clinic. Come on in and let's get the rest of the testing done and see what the heck's going on.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that call, Julia. Bye-bye. Back to a quick break, and back with Hilmer, we're going to talk about rapamycin and monoclonal protein in just a moment.
All right.
Stay right there. This is Leading Edge Medicine.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look in the 5 and 10, glistening once again with candy canes and silver lanes aglow.
Welcome back. We're Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette, along with the doctors in the studio taking your questions, Dr. Samira Umat and Dr. Jerry Mixon. On the phone from Redmond, we have Hilmer. Hi there, Hilmer. Welcome to the show. You had a question about rapamycin?
Yeah, good morning.
Hi there.
Good morning.
I just happened to be found out yesterday. I'm at the tail end of a COVID infection, about 10, 12 days in. But my question is related to rapamycin and COVID. Can I take rapamycin when I have a COVID infection? Is that good or bad or indifferent?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I've never seen a study on rapamycin in COVID patients. You know, and I suspect it's in part because organizing a study takes months and months and months, and by then your patients are all over their COVID. So,
I did find something online, but it was rather technical in nature, and I didn't want to bother reading all that stuff. I thought there was some talk about that it was actually not a bad thing, but
I wouldn't think it would be bad at all. I mean, if you want to know my gut. Rapamycin was originally designed in the soil of Rapa Nui, an island in the Pacific, and it was originally noted to be a very wide-spectrum antibiotic that attacked almost every virus and bacterium around. So, COVID is a viral infection, rapamycin might actually turn out to have some utility in it. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, that's what I gathered, because I'm not. You get lost in the weeds sometimes. You read these studies and stuff, and I go, okay, I'm glazing over now. But the conclusions seem to be like what you're saying. It might be helpful. But now on the other, you mentioned that you got back on metformin now while on rapamycin, because you go on and off. But is there a relationship to if you only take metformin by itself and versus taking metformin and rapamycin, do you reduce metformin to any degree while you take if you're adding rapamycin, or doesn't matter?
No, it shouldn't matter. Assuming your liver and kidney functions are normal, you're going to metabolize them independently. The metabolic half-life of the rapamycin is very, very short. The blood levels peak within about 15 minutes, and within a couple of hours, it's hard to find it in your blood. So, yeah, so rapamycin does what it does very quickly. Okay. So,
I think I'm going to head to the medicine cabinet and take some rapamycin if I can kill this COVID thing.
But, you know, that metformin is a long-term, in many respects, a gentler, more targeted drug. But, you know, what we found was that diabetics tend to die much younger than normal people because diabetes accelerates heart disease and strokes and cancers and all sorts of terrible things. Metformin is, in addition to being a drug that increases sensitivity to insulin, so you don't need as much insulin to lower your sugar. That's why it got used as a diabetic drug for, God, probably 70 or 80 years now, since about the late 50s, early 60s. It's also a sirtuin 1 inhibitor, like rapamycin. So it does its things in a different mechanism because rapamycin raises blood sugar and metformin lowers blood sugar. So we know there's, you know, some very different mechanisms at play here, but they both have an impact on the sirtuin system that we're addressing for longevity. What we found was that diabetics, type 2 diabetics who used metformin to lower their blood sugars actually lived longer than non-diabetics. And diabetics tend to die younger and faster, but diabetics on metformin live longer than non-diabetics. So we said, that's an interesting
finding. That's an interesting side effect.
And so so those of us who want to avoid the adverse effects, that is the rising blood sugars and cholesterols, many of us are adding metformin into our regimen. You know, I tried metformin first, and then I took it. I stopped it because I said, "Well, I'm already on a CERT 1 inhibitor. Why do I need a second one?" And then when I started looking, I said, "Oh, oops, my sugar went up. Okay, I'll go back on the metformin." But now the metformin, you got to be careful with your vitamin Bs. Your B vitamins you don't absorb those as well on metformin.
Last time I mentioned it, you told me go get your B vitamins and folate checked, and I came north of 2,000 on the. It was way above the scale on the B and folate. So I'm off the charts.
Yeah, so you're not deficient, and that would be our worry.
And that's taking metformin 1,500 milligrams a day. So
You're fine.
Yeah,
you're fine.
Okay. Okie dokie. Thank you so much. That was enlightening. Have a good day, folks.
Okay, take care. Now, I'm actually going to, earlier I had said I was going to talk about why occasionally I kick up my rapamycin dose.
Okay.
But I see we've only got, what, 2 or 3 minutes?
Yeah, and we have one more call.
Okay, let's get that call in.
Okay.
Somewhere before we're, let's see, the show ends then.
It went fast today.
All right.